Okay, good morning, everyone. CS mentioned earlier about a prize that we will be giving away to the best speaker. The link for the SurveyMonkey survey is up on the screen at the moment. We'll put this up during each of the coffee breaks. So take down the link, complete the survey, and then based on the results, the best presenters will be winning a prize later. Next up, we have Dan Vieira. Dan is currently in his first year of work at Alexander Forbes in the insurance consulting team. He completed his honors last year at WITS, and his presentation is based on his honors research paper from last year.
Good morning, everybody. As Carla mentioned, I'm Dan, and the title of my presentation is Investigating the Correlation Assumptions Underlying SAM. Okay, so just before I get into the details of the presentation, I think I just want to give you a bit of a background as to where this presentation comes from and why I kind of sort of investigated these things. So what it essentially is, it's an update of my 2015 honors research project. Just a little bit of refinements here and there for some assumptions that I'd made last year in my research project. But kind of the overall intention is to try and produce a paper towards the end of the year and hopefully maybe get it published in perhaps like the South African Actuarial Journal or something similar. It is also I was supervised by Max Popescu. He's a lecturer at WITS. He should have been here today, but unfortunately he couldn't make the seminar. And he's now also the co-author for the paper. So ideally we'll be working on it. We are working on it together. So essentially what it is, it's kind of just an investigation into the underlying assumptions in the SCR calculations that come through in SAM. So it's nothing too groundbreaking. It's not really presenting an overall kind of new model or something that can be used in, as opposed to the regulation. But rather, it's just kind of an investigation to leave everyone with some food for thought as to the kind of investigations that can be done when you consider the different assumptions that are presented within SAM. And the kinds of assumptions that are actually investigate relate to the correlation assumptions that are given. So there's all these huge correlation matrices that are given in the SCR calculations, as well as some of the statistical distribution assumptions that are present throughout the regulation. And also the entire investigation is based off of a simulation study. So it's not really based on any physical data or any kind of actual information that's out there based on insurance companies, but I use what's in the regulation and then use some statistical methods such as Monte Carlo simulations and things to produce results and just see the kinds of effects that happen, the kinds of things that happen to the capital calculations when you change the assumptions within SAM. So why is this relevant? As well, because the regulation is actually just kind of based on your so-called average company, the average business. It's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily imply that it's relevant for every single insurance company, as different insurance companies have different kinds of risk exposures. So changing and looking at the appropriateness of the assumptions that underlie SAM is quite relevant for an insurance company. As well, there is room in SAM for justified changes in assumptions. So these could just be in the form of partial internal models or full-on internal models or just changing an assumption here and there, so long as there's a sound justification based off of the actual experience that an insurance company faces and the exposures and the experiences that they come across. And also what it kind of sort of does, it encourages actively modeling the risks which are inherent in business. So this assists with calculating and justifying appropriate economic capital figures. So while we can all appreciate the SCR calculations are the regulatory capital amounts that come through, the economic capital is where a lot of focus comes in with insurance companies, because there's a recognition that often the SCR might be not appropriate for a particular insurance company based on their risk exposures. So this also, again, translates through to use in internal model processes. And obviously, it just allows for an overall better understanding of your businesses and may assist with strategic decision-making, such as reinsurance decisions, as well as the decisions whether or not more business can be underwritten and those kinds of things. So initially, I'll be starting off just by giving a little brief background on the capital requirements under SAM. So this is a very high-level overview of what comes through in the actual specifications in the discussion documents and position papers. Ideally, the overarching principle is that an insurer should hold enough capital to ensure financial soundness 99.5% of the time in a given year. And so this is to ensure that it's able to withstand the so-called 1 in 200 year event that will happen, that could potentially happen, and they will be financially sound and be able to continue with operations. So what this means, what this translates to in a statistical mathematical standpoint, from a statistical standpoint, is that if you have an overall risk distribution where this kind of reflects the overall risk position that the insurance company faces with all the losses that could potentially happen, the capital requirement is calibrated at the 99.5th percentile of that distribution, also known as the 99.5th value at risk. So that's kind of the overarching principle that comes through. And this comes through with the standard formula that is given in SAM. And the standard formula just kind of looks quite simple. And all it really is an aggregation formula. So it considers the individual capital requirements that should be held based on individual risk exposures. So that could be the risk exposures pertaining to underwriting certain lines of business, market risk exposures, such as exposures to equities and properties, things like that, as well as operational risk. And the overall capital requirement calculation kind of aggregates all of those individual capital requirements. But there is also a correlation factor that forms part of this calculation. And that correlation rho, the linear correlation coefficient, allows for diversification benefits to arise between the different risks, since they are not all perfectly correlated. So rho does not equal 100% for all risk exposures. Another point to mention is that these correlations are pre-specified in the regulation without much detail into their calculations or as to how they were arrived at. And the idea is that they are based on industry analyses with actuarial judgment applied, but essentially SAM also adopts these straight from Solvency II without making much adjustment for the South African context as well. So these are just specified and given straightforward, and the SCR has to be calculated using these correlations. But there is an inherent problem that arises by using linear correlation coefficients, and that's just quite simply that linear correlation is just an average measure of the overall dependence between two random variates. So if you just consider just two random variables, two statistical variables, X and Y, they might have a joint kind of distribution that looks like the graph on the left, where they have kind of an even dependence spread out throughout the entire joint distribution. Or they could have something that looks a little bit more like the graph on the right, where you can see a lot of a much more high dependence coefficient coming through in the upper tail, where if X is taking on a high value, Y is likely to be taking on a similarly high value. Or if X is taking on a, and then the opposite effect happening in the lower tail, where if X assumes a low value, then Y kind of just does its own thing. But the issue is that correlation coefficients don't capture this overall dependence that's being displayed here. So the idea is that both these two graphs have an approximate linear correlation of about 75%. But you can see that there's definitely different kinds of dependence coming through here, and especially in that upper tail where ideally insurers are concerned with the 1 in 200 kinds of events, there's some serious differences in the correlations happening in that tail that isn't captured by the linear correlation coefficient. So ideally, we would need another way to describe dependence more accurately, and this comes through in the form of what is known as copulas. So copulas are quite intimidating mathematical functions, if anyone here knows a little bit about them. But essentially what they are, in just layman's terms, they are statistical functions that completely describe the joint behavior of random variates. So ideally with a copula, you would be able to describe exactly how two random variables will behave together and arrive at their joint distribution. And what they allow for is obviously nonlinear dependence, which is implied by the linear correlation coefficient. So that graph that was on the right that I just showed you, would that kind of dependence would be captured perfectly with a copula. And also, as I mentioned already, they arrive at a multivariate distribution, a joint distribution, just based on the individual given marginal distributions for every single random variable. In this case, we'd be modeling the different risks that an insurer faces. So I'm just going to give you just a brief explanation of how copulas work. It's nothing too technical, but if you just consider the bivariate case, again, where we have X and Y, then you have X and Y as your two random variates. Each of them have distribution functions f of x and f of y. And then you have something which is known as the copula function, which is given by c of u1 and u2. Now u1 and u2 are just any two numbers that lie between 0 and 1. So ideally, what they refer to in the sense of copula is probabilities. Probabilities are actually read into copulas as their inputs. And then you also have the joint distribution of x and y, which is just given by f of xy. So what the idea behind copulas is that any joint distribution f of xy can actually be given by a copula with the marginal distributions read into the copula function as parameters. So this is the overall joint distribution of xy as given by the copula function. So I'm just going to present two examples here of copulas, and just to show you why they could be considered a little bit intimidating mathematically, but their actual functional forms are not too important for the overall study. So this is what is known as the Gaussian bivariate copula. This relates to the Gaussian distribution, or the normal distribution that we're all familiar with, and this is the bivariate case, again, for x and y. So you can see it kind of sort of resembles the functional form of the distribution function for a normal distribution, just the univariate one. But it captures the dependence with its own parameter, which is rho, ironically also the correlation coefficient between the two. So that's the only parameter that you would need to read into this copula, as well as the marginal distributions, which don't have to be normal. They can be any statistical distributions that you read into this copula to produce a joint distribution. And then here's an example of another one, which is known as the Gumbel copula. This is, again, the bivariate case. It's a little less mathematically intimidating, but it has its own parameter alpha, which has to be parametrized in order to use the copula. And what's really interesting about these two is that the Gaussian copula doesn't really have anything particular about dependence in the tails, whereas the Gumbel copula actually has upper tail dependence. So you would notice the difference in the dependence for the lower values of x and y versus the higher values of x and y. So how do copulas and SAM kind of tie together? So the way that I sort of bring them together within my investigation is copulas can be used to describe the nonlinear dependence between risks. So this means that obviously the true risk position can be more accurately modeled for an insurance company on an overall level. So this impacts the diversification benefits, because if a particular copula assumes that risks are not necessarily as dependent on each other, then your overall capital figure ideally would be a little bit more optimistic, and you would expect extreme events to occur less frequently together. So you would have a lower capital requirement coming out, and obviously vice versa for a more prudent copula that assumes extreme events are more likely to occur together more frequently. And another point is just that once you have an understanding of your true risk position, you can obviously allocate capital throughout the business more accurately and achieve better returns on capital, which is also quite an important capital-driven point. Okay, so what I actually did for my investigation, I just focused on one aspect of the regulation, which was the non-life premium and reserve submodule of the SCR calculation. That's why this is relevant here at the STIC, although because of the nature of the regulation and the nature of the standard formula, this actually does apply to most areas, well, to potentially all areas throughout the regulation, these kinds of investigations. So the way that the non-life capital requirements is defined under SAM is that you have your overall capital requirement, which is made up of the aggregate of the individual capital requirements for each line of business. So that's your motor personals, your property personals, etc. And within each of those lines of business, you hold capital for premium risk and for reserve risk, which those two are also aggregated together using the standard formula, well, an altercation of the standard formula. Premium risk is just essentially the risk that, you know, premiums are not as expected in terms of timing, amounts, etc. And reserve risk as well, that reserves are just not sufficient to be meeting the liabilities of the insurance company. So what I initially did, I just considered motor personal as that line of business, and I calculated the capital requirement figures that were coming out using the standard formula. So what I did is within motor personal, I looked at the premium and reserve risks and then aggregated between those. And these are the assumptions that are present in the regulation pertaining to motor personal, is that the risks are log normally distributed. The standard also I mentioned that all capital requirements are calibrated at the 99.5th percentile, but within the regulation for non-life business, the parameters that are written are the standard deviations for each distribution, which are then scaled up to, which are then calibrated up towards the actual capital requirement at the 99.5th level. So the standard deviation for premium risk that is given is 5.6%, and for reserve risk it's 5.5%. And this is the quite important point, is that the correlation between premium and reserve is 50%, as just given in the regulation. And again, like I mentioned, capital is calibrated at the 99.5th percentile. And then you also have to account for some volume measures. So just to make this a little bit more realistic, I didn't want to just assume an equal split between premium and reserve. So my co-author and I managed to source just some of the data from the 2013 returns on technical provisions and premiums, and we just based the entire thing on the split of that those two volumes. So everything is done proportionally and assuming that you have one unit underwritten in motor personal. So given all of those assumptions, the standard formula says that there's an overall standard deviation for this line of business of 4.97%. So that's accounting for that correlation. And then scaling that up, you have an overall capital requirement relative to the mean of 13.5%. So now this is now where my investigation actually kicks off, is that 50% assumption between the two risks, I changed that around by looking at different kinds of dependence measures between the two risks. So the way that I do this is by assuming different copulas, and I'll actually just take you through a step methodology of what I did. So I parameterized, I kept the idea of log normality consistent just based on the regulation, and I parameterized these distributions based off of those standard deviations. Then I parameterized copulas based on that correlation assumption. So I actually investigated those two copulas that I showed you the functional forms for earlier, the Gaussian and the Gumbel. And for the Gaussian copula, where you actually have to have a correlation coefficient as a parameter, I used the 50%, and then I parameterized the Gumbel copula using software, parameterization software. And then I used the log normal marginals in conjunction with the copulas to produce bivariate distributions. So I arrived at a joint distribution for premium and reserve. And then I simulated from this joint distribution and then aggregated everything together to arrive at a single risk position, one whole distribution that should completely describe the risk for motor personal. And then from this distribution, I calculated the standard deviation and hence the 99.5th value at risk for this distribution. So these were the results that I came across. So you can see under the Gaussian copula, we kind of have that that linear uniform dependence happening throughout the entire distribution, with nothing too extreme happening at either tail of the joint distribution. Whereas in the Gumbel copula, as I mentioned, since this is a copula calibrated or parameterized to have upper tail dependence, you can see that there's definitely a clustering of values in the upper tail. What this translates to numerically is this table here, where we, for the regulatory capital, the standard deviation came to about 4.97%, as I showed you earlier. Under the Gaussian copula, it now arrives at about 4.92%, which is a reduction of 1%. And under the Gumbel copula, it's at 4.92 as well, which is also approximately 1% reduction. But that doesn't mean much in terms of the actual capital requirements, since everything is calibrated at the 99.5th. So you can see that the difference from the 99.5th and the mean under the Gaussian copula is about 13.52%, which is pretty much in line with what was coming through in the regulation. And that actually gave me a little bit a bit of confidence in my investigation, because I was hoping that assuming a Gaussian copula wouldn't be any different from just assuming a linear correlation, since the dependence there isn't the dependence is uniform throughout the entire joint distribution there. So the fact that this actually replicated what was coming out of the regulation made me pretty happy. And then the Gumbel copula, we had a bit of an increase in the capital requirements, or that difference there, of about 5.2%. So this actually doesn't really mean much, since all the figures are just based off of simulations. But essentially what I want to illustrate here is that there's definitely a lot of sensitivity that comes through when you change the assumptions, and what actually happens where you assume a particular copula as opposed to a correlation, that your capital actually jumps up about 5.2% based on this. So another thing is just that this isn't necessarily saying that, you know, a Gumbel copula is the accurate or this is the way to model capital from now on or something like that. It's just kind of an investigation and saying this is what happens if you had to assume this Gumbel copula. And this, ideally, an increase wouldn't make most insurers very happy, because we would hopefully be wanting a little bit more diversification benefit to pull through, and hopefully a reduction in capital. But what this does illustrate is that if an insurer can justify the use of a copula as opposed to a correlation coefficient, or the use of assumption A over assumption B that's coming through in the regulation, and they are able to actually calculate their capital like that, and then they notice something like this, an increase in capital, then they should realize that ideally there might be an understating of capital that's coming through in the regulation, and that they are not in a truly solvent position just by holding the regulatory capital. So that, hopefully, there's an appreciation for that result that's coming through, that, you know, under your economic capital side of things, you actually might be understating your risk position, and you should be holding this amount of capital or something like that. But then, as some further methodology, I didn't just want to stop there and look at only the copulas and what changing correlation assumptions could do. I also investigated changing the actual distributional assumption, so changing that log normal distribution assumption that was mentioned earlier. And the way that I actually went about doing this, I'll just give you a bit more of a stepped methodology. So essentially what I did, I parameterized new risk distributions based on the standard deviations that were given from the log normal distributions. So I wanted to keep everything consistent so that any differences that were coming through are based on the inherent properties of the distributions, as opposed to my own parameterization techniques or something like that. And also, another point is just that in reality, there might not actually be enough data to accurately parameterize by calibrating at the 99.5th percentile. At the very least, you'd need 200 points if you're trying to model the 1 in 200 event. And oftentimes, depending on what you are modeling, that there just might be a limit to the amount of data available. So parameterizing at the standard deviation level made a little bit of sense for our investigation. And then what I did from these distributions, I simulated independent sample, an independent pairwise sample. So those were completely independent. And then I correlated the sample using the regulatory correlation of 50%. So that ideally the amounts, the correlation figures that were coming through would be around the regulation, and that any changes further to that assumption, the changing the correlation to a copula, for example, would be from the inherent properties, again, of the copula. And then what I did, I parameterized the copulas using techniques such as MLE, maximum likelihood estimation techniques, and also just, again, because since I used the Gaussian copula, I needed to specify the actual linear correlation as the parameter, so then I used that 50% for this parameterization process. And then from there, I proceeded to find the aggregate distribution from the copula, from the joint distribution that came out. And from this aggregate, the way I did that, I actually just simulated from the copula, from the joint distribution again, and then I aggregated together and found the standard deviation of 99.5. So these were the results that came out of that. So this is the first image that I've already shown based on the log normal distributions for the Gaussian and the Gumbel. Then I changed things around and I used the normal distribution, which technically isn't the most appropriate distribution given an insurance context because of also the negative values that can come through. But it is a common assumption often just when in modeling. So I decided to investigate this as well and just see what happened. Again, we can see that the only real properties that we can notice with the difference between these two graphs is just that there's an effect of the upper tail dependence coming through for the Gumbel copula. And you'll see that this is actually consistent throughout all of them. The next one I decided to look at was an exponential distribution, which also has like a decaying tail. So I thought it might be relevant to just look at that. And it's also functionally easy to work with. Again, you can see a clustering coming out of the Gumbel copula. And then another distribution was just the gamma distribution that I used as well. And again, the same kind of effects are coming through. So numerically, that translates to, this is the first table that I showed you with the log normal distributions. Under the normal distributions, we can see already there's the standard deviation under the Gaussian copula actually stayed around the same. It was about 0.1% increase, so there's hardly any real difference there. And under the Gumbel copula, it actually decreased a little bit to by 1.2%, but that doesn't mean much. So at the 99.5 level, we notice that there's actually quite a significant decrease in the capital under the Gaussian copula of about 6.4%. And so there you can already see the kind of sensitivity that's coming through just by changing that assumption. Technically, I don't think that this would ever be an appropriate assumption or a justifiable assumption, but the idea is that you should be able to kind of come up with different distributions based on the data that's available, and data and distribution parameterization techniques should pull through. And if a normal copula could fit and the actuaries working on this kind of investigation felt confident or comfortable using a normal copula, normal distributions, there's already some room there to see that there could be a potential decrease in the capital requirement. The Gumbel copula, however, showed an increase in the capital requirement, and that kind of sort of was expected because of the upper tail dependence that comes through. The exponential distributions went a little bit haywire, and the percentiles that came through, you can see that under the Gaussian copula, we actually had a huge increase in capital requirement of about 52%. So the exponential distribution technically isn't likely to be very accurate either, but I attributed this to extreme values pulling through and distorting the results. So this would be an indication that a lot of judgment is applied, and even if an insurance company were to kind of investigate these changing assumptions and they found that a particular distribution fits their data accurately, leaving it there isn't just good enough. You'd have to actually go in and kind of really look at kind of an actual versus expected scenario and see if the kinds of figures that are coming out are reasonable and applicable to what's actually happening in reality. So in my head, this is an indication of a potential investigation where something has gone wrong and the capital requirement just jumped up way too significantly. Under the Gumbel copula, you can see, of course, there's an even bigger increase because of that upper tail dependence. And then the gamma distributions, again, also gave some pretty interesting results, not as extreme as the exponential distributions, but nonetheless increases in the capital requirements that were presented. So just before I actually touch on the issues that I still have to address relating to this entire investigation, I just also again want to drive home the idea that these kinds of investigations are appropriate for economic capital kinds of situations where we obviously have to calculate the regulatory capital, but we can't just leave it there and assume that we are in a solvent position. And these are the kinds of investigations that could be done to assist with the economic capital process and the internal modeling process of the true risk position of an insurer. But some of the issues that came up, in particular for this presentation that I was trying to get done before this presentation to show the results, certain copulas didn't work out too well with the modeling. There's one known as the multivariate T copula, which is based around the student's T distribution. There's an extra parameter that is required for that copula that I couldn't really justify using or coming up with a particular value for that copula, rather parameter for the copula. And I actually just chose not to display the results because they were just too drastically different from everything else that was coming out. And so I'd have to obviously look at these kinds of things just to assess the applicableness of these kinds of certain copulas in these situations or investigations. Another factor that also came up with some issues was when I investigated the generalized Pareto distribution, which I thought was a pretty appropriate distribution given an insurance context. There's lots of research to suggest that risks and losses could be well fitted with a generalized Pareto distribution. And I, again, also came up with issues in the parameterization stage of the investigation, so I decided also again not to display those results. But nonetheless, there are still areas of future investigation that my co-author and I have to actually look at in the preparation to get hopefully this paper published, and that would be more suitable copulas. So not only limiting investigation to a handful of copulas or the well-known copulas, but using other copula generation techniques which are actually out there. And also, for example, another copula known as the heavy right-tailed copula, which implies a lot more dependence in the upper right tail than the Gumbel copula actually does. So that overall would imply higher capital calculations, but it's rather capital requirements. But it's again another area to focus on or investigate. Further to that would be more suitable distributions that could be looked at. There's a whole array of distributions statistically that are out there, and looking at a lot more distributions in an insurance context would make sense as well in the run-up for the publication, hopefully. And a major area would obviously then be to look at minimizing model error with goodness of fit tests and actually testing whether or not these are appropriate assumptions to be made, certain copulas, choosing certain copulas over others or certain distributions over others, and assessing actual versus kind of expected, even within the simulation study. And then lastly, another interesting point that we really want to focus on is modeling the hierarchical effects that come through within the regulation. So as I showed you before in that cascading diagram, there's obviously room to be modeling between lines of business as well, not only within the one motor personal line of business, and testing how sensitive overall the regulation is to change, well, rather the capital calculations are to changes in assumptions at that level. So perhaps considering a different class of business, such as property personal or marine or something along those lines, and aggregating at that level, and again, changing the assumptions to see the sensitivity. And essentially, that is the end of my presentation. So thank you for your time and your attention. Any questions?
Daniel, thanks very much. That was extremely interesting. I've just got a few comments actually from the point of view of the non-life underwriting risk working group. I'm not sure if you were involved with them at all.
No.
One of the things that I thought would be interesting was you made certain assumptions in your simulations about the distributions, and then again the copulas, and the non-life underwriting risk group looked at each class in isolation. But when setting the correlation assumptions, or we're modifying them from solvency two, we just kind of used a a very broad brush approach? Was it, we assumed Gaussian, and was it high, medium, low correlation? But the next step in the work, which we thought, you know, it would be a refinement in a couple of years' time, was to actually work, move on to the work that you're doing. Mm-hmm. And the group actually had the data to do that. So kind of 15 years of data on loss ratios and reserve variation over time. So it would be a very interesting exercise to compare what that data says to the assumptions that you you've made.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that actually sounds pretty interesting. I mean, using actual data to see what's coming out, and then at the very least being able to justify certain assumptions based on actual data and not just kind of hoping for the best with what's coming out in my simulation. Yeah, yeah. That sounds quite interesting.
So then it would be more of a, I think, if the work that the non-life underwriting group does incorporates, you kind of work together in a sense, it would be bringing together of what the regulations say, and what the data is actually saying.
Yes, yeah,
But then there's also the technical difficulty of if you've got a Gumbel correlation, to actually express it in a matrix form, it becomes more difficult.
Yeah, because you can't just express that with an individual. Yeah, there'd have to be an entire modeling process that goes into that. Basically, kind of for each individual capital calculation, because that dependence cannot just be accurately captured within that one little coefficient.
And then, kind of leading from that point, that particular point, I wanted to ask if you've got a view, if there's particular correlations within the non-life underwriting risk specifications where the Gaussian assumption is particularly inappropriate.
So I didn't actually investigate on that level of detail. Like, I didn't actually specifically target areas and hope to find somewhere where there'd be an inappropriate assumption or something. But I did notice what I ended up doing as well after simulating everything. I calculated empirical correlations just based off of the results that were coming out, just to kind of assess, you know, so the regulation implied 50%. Now, what is this sort of saying versus what? And the general consensus across everything was just that under the Gaussian copula, everything was kind of sort of around 50% as well, just give or take a few decimal places, which is expected if obviously everything is calibrated using now the Gaussian copula, as you just said. But the Gumbel copula just had slightly higher correlations, which again would be expected just based off of the upper tail dependence. But again, that cannot accurately model everything about the distributions or everything about the joint behavior of the risks. That would have to be modeled explicitly using the Gumbel copula itself. So the empirical correlations implied that there would be slightly higher figures coming out if you happen to use a Gumbel copula, but nowhere could I actually, in my investigation, turn around and say, okay, well, now that 50% is wrong, let's rather use 58% or something like that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi, I think the next question must come from the far side again. Thanks for the presentation. I found it interesting. And I just wanted to check my understanding. When you calculated the 99.5th var less the mean, mm-hmm. was that the mean from that particular distribution?
Yes, yeah. Okay. So in order, because of the nature of the investigation, I couldn't parameterize I couldn't find a particular value for every parameter accurately just based off of what I had. So I had to make some assumptions here and there, but then in order to standardize everything across that, I only considered the difference between the particular mean of those distributions and the 99.5th, so that everything was at the very least comparable.
Okay, because I was curious to know how much of the difference between the different distributions and the different copulas was due to the 99.5th percentile being different versus the mean being different.
Right.
It might be quite useful to look at what the mean was. And
individually.
Especially on the reserving risk side, you do have a view of what the mean is, because that's your technical provision.
Yeah.
So it might be useful just to kind of tease those out.
Okay.
Otherwise, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Cool. Thank you.
I think that's about the time.
Question.
One more. Andre always have to get a slot in.
Thanks, Dan. That was quite good. Maybe just from my side, I think I like simplicity in the world, and I think if I look at the standard formula nowadays, I've said before, I think it might become difficult to explain it in layman terms for some of the board of directors. So, you know, I think I recall at least three areas where we already have some diversification. So it's between life or the premium and the reserve risk, classes of business, and then between market, non-life, underwriting risk. You know, you try and diversify those across.
Yeah.
Having said that, if I take my hat off and I put the other one on, I'd love to see if you unpack the component of the premium risk side into the more traditional capital reserving ways in terms of attritional losses, large losses, and cat losses. My gut feel tells me that there should be a different correlation behavior between those different aspects in the different classes of business, which just brings more complexity to the game, but way more accuracy.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think the suggestions that Lisa made is, I think as an industry, it'd be good to see if we can use some actual data and understand, you know, the correlations, assumptions we assume is right, because the author says you've got to go check if your underlying risk profiles actually matches the regulatory and make adjustments. I think we all try and avoid the, you know, we'll just assume the standard or the standard correlations in there is appropriate, but it'd be very useful for us to understand some of that, even if we don't bring it back to the board of directors to explain it to them, or we think of a different way how to contextualize it. But I think the work you're doing is something that we all avoid, but I think we can't avoid indefinitely. Thanks.
Okay, cool. I'll keep that in mind. Thank you. Yeah, I definitely agree that there would definitely be differences across those within premium, for example, the traditional large. There's inherent differences there that should accurately be modeled or captured at the very least, or attempted to. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.